The story of Joseph and his brothers is obviously very disturbing, but you know, sibling rivalry has been around for a long time, right? And as much of the book of Bereishit is about sibling rivalry, but how we see that how far they're willing to take it, and to and I don't know if we shared this last week, or shared it in the other class, when you know they put him in a pit and they sold him for slavery, right? In both cases, we had the different ideas. We had Reuven, who the oldest brother said, "Let's put him in a pit," right? And we see from the narrator that it says, and his intention was to come and get him back. And the brothers like, but they didn't tell that to his brothers, and they said, "Yeah, we'll throw him in a pit." If you throw someone in a pit without any water, right, what's going to happen? They're going to die, right? So to say that this was a more moral decision, right? Let's not kill him by the sword. Let's have him die of dehydration. I'm hard pressed to say that was a more moral or a higher moral decision. That they said let's not kill him. Let's throw him in a pit, and that way he'll die that way and not through our hands. I'm hard pressed to say that was a greater moral decision, right?
Let nature take its course.
That's very nice, but you're causing them. They're causing that, right? So if there are many. I don't want to get demented here, or whatever. If you tie somebody up and you turn on their gas and then leave the house, so they're going to die of gas inhalation. I didn't do it. The gas did it, right? I mean, that's how far is that? That's also unethical. But we're going to talk about that in just a moment, because there is a point that their hands are off. And then Yehuda comes along and he says, "Let us not do this to our brother. He is our brother. He is our flesh. What should we do instead? We should
sell him.
We'll sell him, right? And we can get a deal." And Jews have been pursuing deals ever since. So, like, if you look at it and you think from it face value, you would say, "Oh, you know what? Well, that's more ethical. Why? Because you're not going to kill him. He's our brother. How can we do that? You're not going to kill him, right?" But understand what happens in those times if you sell somebody. What happens to them?
They become slaves,
right? And if you're a slave, generally speaking, at that period of time, then what's going to happen to you is that you will be worked to your death for a few years, if you survive that long, and then you're dead, right? So again, none of this is of any higher morality here. So what we're seeing, they're basically killing him. They're basically killing him. And then we have that on the one side, and then we have the other side. And the other side is from this week's portion, which is Joseph's revenge. Or is it revenge? The way he deals with his brothers is, as soon as he sees them, he says, "Aha, he recognizes them, they don't recognize him," right? And then he takes his vengeance. Let's remember, what does he do to them? Without going into this, normally we like to read the text, but it's a long story, so I don't know. So first thing he does is
he sends them home,
but he doesn't send them home. He frames them, right? And says,
and
puts the money back and said, "You stole this," right? So then and he takes Shimon as ransom, and they said, "I don't trust you at all. Bring Benjamin back here." They go back to the land of Canaan. They hang out there until they run out of food and they're really starving. And then he again switches it and places the goblet into Benjamin's bag and frames him. And so he's torturing them, right? And of course, this is revenge. Having other, you know, brothers, this is something we would do for fun, right? You would pick on them and do it for fun. This doesn't sound so Jewish, right? Benjamin is the youngest. It's his youngest, and it's his full brother, right? So is he picking on Benjamin, or really he's picking on the older brothers who basically, you know, gave their word to their father, "We're going to be able to bring Benjamin back." And now when this happens, he frames Benjamin, right? So we haven't seen whether he's torturing Benjamin more. I think he's torturing the other brothers as well, because now they are going to go, "Oh my God, what are we going to do? We just promised Dad that we have to come back. And how, like, this is just terrible. How are we going to do all this?" Now again, we know the end of the story. Parshat Vayigash is that Yosef reveals himself, and immediately what does he say? It was not you. It was all the hand of God, etc., etc. And it seems to be that Joseph forgives his brothers, right? It seems to be in the VeggieTales version of the story, which is an important thing. If you haven't watched VeggieTales, it's important. It's a child. They have like vegetables that dress up as and do biblical stories, right? It's Christian, but it's lovely, and it's good, and it has vegetables. There are no donut tales, by the way. So in the VeggieTales version of the story, they all hug, there's cheering, and they all go home. Does Joseph forgive his brothers, by the way? How do we know? Because it's in the book.
The first question is my father's still alive.
Ken.
Once he gets past this, give them place to live.
No, he says very nice things. In fact, let's look at it. It's next week's portion, but it's important to look at the text because it seems to be that he says really, really nice things. Like Joseph gets very frugal. 252. Joseph gets very, very religious. After doing all this, spending however many months it seems to be, or a long time, to torturing his family, what does he do when he finally reveals himself? He tells them, on page 252, verse 5, "And now, be not distressed, nor reproach yourselves for having sold me here, for it was to be a provider that God sent me ahead of you. For this has been two of the hunger years in the midst of the land, and there are just yet 5 years in which there shall be neither plowing nor harvest." How many years of hunger was there supposed to be? How many years of famine? Fat cows, skinny cows, right? Right. So he says, so the 7 years, so we have 2 years into it, so there's 5 more years left. God sent me here to take care of the world, to basically feed you and to save our family. Thus God has sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival in the land and to sustain you for a momentous deliverance. And now, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me father to Pharaoh, master of his entire household, and ruler throughout the entire land of Egypt. Hurry, go and get father, etc., etc., and I will take care of everyone. Okay? So we're on top of page 255. Right? So here you have, he reveals himself, and you would think that he would be, you sons of blah, blah, blah. Right? He doesn't do that. He says, okay, now that I played my little game, let me just tell you, it's all God's hands. I'm very religious. Anyway, don't be angry, and etc., etc. Right? So at least in the text, David, it seems to be, at least from what he's saying over here, right in initially, he says, I am Joseph, my father's still alive, and now don't be sad, because God sent me here. It sounds great, right? So, but does he forgive them? Does he say, he says, this is all part of God's plan. Does he say, I forgive you?
No.
And how do I know that he doesn't forgive them? We have a 929er over here, so you should know the answer. How do I know? Because there's another verse that are seen at the end of Parshat Vayechi, where it tells us at the end of the book of Genesis, which is like, you would think that here everybody would love each other again, but there's something missing. At the end of the book of Genesis, on page 289, the brothers approach 287 and 289, right? Let's look at 287. Verse 15. Joseph's brothers, 287, verse 15. Joseph's brothers perceived that their father was dead, right? It wasn't very hard. They had a whole funeral. I don't know why. They just perceived. They realized. They said, wait a second. Dad's gone, right? Dad's gone. Dad was the patriarch of the family. When the patriarch of the family is here, everybody's going to do what they're supposed to do, because in honor of Dad, that's what we have to do. But when they perceived, they realized, wait a second, now Dad's gone. What's going to happen tomorrow in the new normal? And he says, perhaps Joseph will nurse hatred against us, and he will surely repay us for all the evil that we did him. How do I know that Joseph didn't forgive them? Because they didn't think Joseph forgave them. This is, let's do the math. Jacob is 130 years old when he comes down to Egypt. He lives the last 17 years of his life in Egypt and dies in Egypt at the age of 147. So this is 17 years later. Jacob, right? I'm sorry, so Jacob. This is 17 years later. Thank you. 17 years later. So it's been a long time, right? That every Thanksgiving they kind of sit together and they you know, they do everything they're supposed to do. By the way, a lot of families are like this. And they say everything they're supposed to say, but everybody's wondering what's going on behind the scenes. What does Joseph really feel? Because Joseph never said, I forgive you. He doesn't say this. And so they approach Joseph and Sharon, we're going to take them to finish the scene because it gets even further. And they think that Joseph waited till their father died and then he's going to take revenge. By the way, who said, I'm going to wait till my father died and then take revenge?
Didn't Esau say that?
Esau said it. Right? That's a family tradition. By the way, Esau doesn't take revenge after their father died. Esau doesn't take revenge. That's another talk at another time. But that's important to note. That's what he says in his heat of his anger. So they just assumed we have a legendary story about Uncle Esav. Obviously, Joseph's going to wait. And now that it's over, it's 17 years later. He's waited for that moment. He has the power to do whatever he wants. He is second in command in the most powerful country in the world. So of course he's going to take it. So what did they do? They had an idea. So they instructed Joseph and he'd be told, your father gave orders before his death, the top of page 289, and he said, thus shall you say to Joseph, oh, please kindly forgive the spiteful deed of your brothers and their sin, for they have done you evil. So now please forgive the spiteful deed of the servants of your father's God. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. He said, please forgive us now, right? Forgive us, right? Don't take revenge and forgive us. They're asking for forgiveness 17 years later. His brothers also wept, and they flung themselves before him and said, we are ready to be your slaves. Do whatever you want with us. Please just forgive us, don't take revenge. But Joseph said to them, fear not, for am I instead of God? Although you intended me harm, God intended it for good, in order to accomplish. It is clear as day that a vast people be kept alive. So now fear not, I will sustain you and your young ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke to their hearts. So he says, no, don't worry about it. It's fine. That's all part of God's plan. What's missing?
Still doesn't say I forgive you.
Not only that, but look at the words what he says. He says, you intended me for harm. God intended it for good. I know what you did. God's going to judge you because God changed the plan. If it were up to you, I'd be long dead. And this, but God had a divine plan, and I'm part of this divine plan, and so therefore, great. There is no forgiveness here. They are feeling better because they know he's not going to kill him, right? But there is no forgiveness here. Sharon, you want to say something?
What I was going to say, though, was how do we know that he didn't, in fact, forgive them and that it's not their guilt that makes them feel?
Right. Jewish guilt. Okay. Right? Jewish guilt we've been doing for a very long time. Yeah. It's plausible, but he doesn't say it.
Yes.
Right. So it's possible, Sharon, you're right, you're a Jewish mother, and you say, of course, they're all getting along, whatever. And it's possible you're right, and that's one side to look at it, or you can look at another side. There are different ways to look at it. I'm inclined to say, and again, from Joseph's behavior, you're right. Right? But the way Joseph says it, whatever, it's all good, it's fine. I said, why are you worried about that? I told you I forgive you, let's go. We had this conversation a long time ago. But he doesn't say that. There are words that are missing, and I think that it's intentionally ambiguous to let us know that something is still missing. Right? That's a possibility. So, but with that, everybody got what we said here so far? So with that, I want to understand, right? That even if I say that Joseph didn't forgive them at the end, why does he go through this whole charade? Why does he go through this entire charade, not the 17 years, I'm talking about the years when they were going back and forth and they didn't know who he was, and he said, and he's challenging them, he's threatening them, he's making their lives miserable. Why does he go through this whole charade? If he thought this was all from God as it said, why does he go through this whole charade for this whole, which basically the whole portion is through all those charades?
I honestly think that he's still thinking revenge. He just doesn't know how.
Ah, okay. So one of the opinions, it's interesting, David, you say this, because one of the opinions said is that he didn't, there are two types of people who have been, who are looking for vindication, right? There are the people who sit there and plan that when I get a chance to see them again, I have this all mapped out. I have the blueprint, right? Those are the people who go postal, and they're a little psychotic. And then Joseph was busy, right? I mean, he spent 9 years in a dungeon, but he was busy, right? So he didn't plan his revenge. He never expected his revenge. So he's almost taken off guard. They show up, and he's like, oh, my gosh, well, let's do it, whatever, right? He just didn't know. He didn't expect, what are the odds this would ever happen, that they would all show up? And so David's, as I said, some of the commentators point this out, is that he wasn't necessarily planned out. And then he kind of, dominoed until he was set the opportunity to reveal himself. That's a possibility. There are others, and that we're gonna jump on. But hear the question.
Well, maybe he also wanted to see whether they had learned from what they did, whether they had changed.
They changed. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to hold on to that thought. Okay. That's a possibility. Because I want to ask another question. The other question, which has always bothered me since I was a little boy, which is, why doesn't Joseph send a telegram and say, hey, Dad, you're not going to believe this, but you remember when you thought, you probably think I'm dead, because I've been gone for a number of years, but now actually I'm the second in command. I run the most powerful country in the world, right? Send a telegram. You know what? Maybe he's concerned. There's the Jews. He didn't have a cell phone, right? So he can't send a text. But he could send a message. Remember, he's a big shot.
He has the capabilities.
Right? He has the capabilities. He's a big shot now. Now, if you want to see, maybe he wanted to wait a little bit. You wait a few months because he's new in the job. He doesn't want anybody to question his allegiance, right? Remember that. So he, in the beginning of the story, and just to highlight, it says that he's referred to when the butler says, Do you know a guy who does dreams, right? That's basically how it is. And the butler goes, I know a guy. I got a guy. He does great dreams. He does carburetors. He does dreams. He does whatever. I know a guy, right? So he says, I know a guy. And who's this guy? He's an Ivri. Right away, he reveals him that he's a foreigner. He's a stranger, right? The commentaries don't like that, about that he did that, because he was like, he's a young Ivri. He's a young boy, and he's not one of us, right? And so immediately, there's probably a concern for Joseph that there's a xenophobia issue, right? And so he wants to feel a little more comfortable. So maybe he's not ready the first month, the second month, the third month. It's 2 years. It's 2 years. 2 years that he doesn't send a telegram to his father. Secure and save the country, save the region, save the world. He could probably do whatever he wants, and nobody would care, right? And so, he doesn't reach out to his father. Why doesn't he reach out to his father?
At the beginning, he doesn't tell you.
She raised her hand.
Sorry.
you get this at home also? Yes, Susan.
Actually, maybe he remembers the fact that his father admonished him.
So Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun, who's one of the great biblical scholars, proposes something that seems to be a little bit outrageous.
Joshua's
but.
Father.
He took the name. Right. But Rabbi Ben Nun, if you read Rabbi Ben Nun, he was one of the paratroopers in the, if you read the book like Dreamers, he's mentioned in an amazing, and goes on a limb and says, you know what, he actually thought that perhaps Joseph presumed that his father was in on it. Right. If you remember in the beginning of the story in Parshat last week, it says that when he tells his father about the dreams, about there were two dreams. The second dream, he says there were the stars and the sun and the moon, and they're all bowing down to him. And what did Joseph say? I'm sorry, what did Jacob say? He yells at him and says, you think my father and your mother, who's dead, right? We should bow down to you. What is that? But it says, by Shamarat and Davar, he kept it to his word. But publicly, at least to the family, he yelled at him. And then, by the way, the last time he saw his father, what did his father do to him? What did his father say to him? He said, go and see the peace of your brothers and the peace of the sheep. You got to see the sheep probably were much more peaceful than the brothers. He sends them to his brothers, right? And you got to look at the text here because well, that's very nice. It was probably not a good idea.
Father was sending him to
be. Obviously, thought that the brother was going to do something for him because he needed the brother.
If you look at the text on page 201, 203. Page 203, it says. His brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. And Israel, well, I'll talk about it now.
That area comes up again.
Israel, the city of Shechem comes up quite often. But, you know, we know the city of Shechem because we talked about it a couple weeks ago.
Dina.
That's where
Dina.
That's the story of Dina. By the way, the city of Shechem we refer to it and like Philadelphia. It's the city of brotherly love. It's the city where they proved their allegiance to their family. If they ended up in Shechem, it's possible, at least one of the commentaries points out, if they ended up in Shechem, they would have just seen him as his brother, because that's when they were united as a family, right? But he doesn't end up in Shechem. They end up in Dothan. It's interesting that the text tells us this. But he was sent to the city of Shechem. Shechem is also famous. Why? Because that's where Abraham entered the land. That's where Abraham enters the land. And by the way, when Jacob returns back from being gone for 20 years, right? How does he enter the land? He goes to the city of Shechem. So the city of Shechem is where you enter the land, right? It also tells us the city of Shechem is where you enter the land. Where did they end up? They went to the city of Shechem, stopped by Beit El, where do they live? In Hebron, right? We had that discussion, not sure if you were here, I was at the time, where they lived in Hebron. Now, geographically, we can look at a map and it doesn't make so much sense, but the text is trying to tell us symbolism, right? So it says that go now and see the welfare of your brothers. I'm sorry, come and I will. Your brothers are pastor in Shechem, are they not? Come and I will send you to them. He said to him, here I am. We're going to go back to that in a second. He said to him, go now, look at the welfare of your brothers and welfare of the flock and bring them back word. So he sent them from the depth of Hebron and he arrived at Shechem. Now remember that the Torah is not a history book. So it doesn't really matter where they come from. There's symbolism of the geography. And the symbolism is that when Abram enters the land and when Jacob enters the land, where does he go? He goes from Shechem to Hebron, right? When Joseph is leaving the land, the symbolism is here. He goes from Hebron to Shechem to out of the land. There's some poetry going on here that the text is trying to share with us. And what I want to go back to that phrase here, because it says that Jacob calls up to Joseph and says, go speak and say, go find out the welfare of the sheep and the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the sheep. And what does Joseph respond? I'm here. What's that word? Hineni. Hineni, right? Hineni is not just an organization.
As you told us, Abraham responded.
Same thing.
Right?
Young rice, yes. So she chose it for a reason, because what does Hineni mean? Right?
I'm here spiritually.
Here I am. So I'm here spiritually. What else? When God speaks to Avram and says, take your only son and I want you to sacrifice it, what does Avram say? Hineni. By the way, when Yitzchak turns to him and says, hey dad, where are we going? What does Avram say to Yitzchak? Hineni, right? The commentaries point out that Hineni is not just, hi, here I am. Hineni is, I'm here to do whatever you want. Whatever you say. I might not be happy with what you're asking me to do, but I'm here to do whatever you say. That's where it comes in. I have complete allegiance to you because that's what you're asking me to do. When Jacob says to Joseph, hi, I want you to go see how your brothers are doing, right? Because they're out working in the field and you're probably watching cable television at home, right? Or whatever he was doing. And he says, hineni, which means, dad, I don't think this is a good idea. They hate me, right? But if this is what you ask me to do, hineni, I'm going to do whatever you ask me.
When you walk into your house, do you say that?
When I go into my house?
You say hineni?
No. When I walk into my house, I say hi, and nobody looks up. Right? It's me, your father, I pay the bills, right?
That's it. Who?
Right. Oh, hi, daddy. Sorry about that. Right.
Yes. That's
not a good day. Right? They acknowledge my existence. So when we go back to the question of Rabbi Ben Nun is saying, wait a second, the last thing that Joseph heard from his father is, go do this thing that is a terrible idea. It's an absolute terrible idea. And so he says, I'll do whatever you want, Dad, but it's a really lousy idea. So there was a possibility, at least, that maybe he believed that his father was in on it. And it's not crazy. Because if you remember with each story, in every generation, there was one child that was chosen and another child that was sent away. Right? There's Abraham and Ishmael, by the way, and Lot. And Lot. There's and there is Isaac and Esau. Esau is not included. And so it would make sense, actually, who's actually sent away in the previous generation? It wasn't Jacob, it was Jacob. Jacob was sent away, right? And then there's another generation, and who knows how this is supposed to play out, right? Again, we know the end of the story. Who knows how it's supposed to play out? And he says, maybe I'm the odd one out. Is it possible that maybe my father was in on it? Rabbi Ben Nun makes this proposal. It's hard to digest it, but you can find it in the text. What I do know is that we are able to understand what Joseph is thinking or how he is feeling how he's feeling in relation to his family. And how do we know this? This is an important lesson because we can always learn what people are thinking when they name their children. Right? Now, what do? We name our children after dead people. Right? In the olden days, they didn't do that. It's far even when they're not dead, right? We never remember. In the olden days, they didn't do that. I always say this to my father. My father would say, because every name that we had, we changed the name slightly. This was named after my grandfather's name was Shalom. We named my daughter Shlomit, right? For everyone, we did change the names. So my father used to say, "I believe. Don't you think you have to name the exact name if the person was named was Sprinza Yenta, right? So then you have to have the exact thing." And you're all nodding your head, right? Because I clearly am a different generation. I'm not naming my grandfather's name was Irving, right? I'm not naming my kid Irving. It's just not going to happen. It's making a comeback, I'm sure, right? Listen, there are names that are making comebacks, like Sophie and Ella and all these names, right? They're making comebacks. It's quite.
Listen, my father was Zussman. My grandson is Zev.
Right. So you change it because Zussman's just not. You don't want to get the kid beaten up on the playground, right? So I said to my father, when he gave me this guilt trip with each kid, right? And I said, "Wait, Dad, how many children did Yaakov have?" Right? So at least we know he had 12 boys and a girl, right? How many did he name after his grandfather, right? And he was a great man, right? He was pretty good, father of three major religions, right? He didn't name a single one after his grandfather. I said, because that time they didn't name after dead people, right? So that's the thing.
Someone, I named my kids after trees.
Trees, yeah. Right? Ilan.
Ilana.
There you go. Okay, so you like trees. And you think that's...
No, I avoided a fight between the families.
There you go. Right. By the way, and Israelis will name anything. Like, there's actually... I know somebody named Moron, right? I'm like, you might not want to bring that to America, right? So, it's true, by the way. Moron. Yeah, terrible name.
If you have a relative, they named you Jezebel.
Yeah, and I had a friend who named their daughter Jezebel, and I'm like... Did you read the book? Read the book. Delilah also, read the book. Don't just choose a name, read the book. All right, so here we learn a great deal, especially from the Torah, from the Bible, of when people name their children, what are they thinking? And of course, Joseph has two sons.
So what significance is it?
Funny. There's some way you read the book. It's in here. it's in this week's portion. So if you go to Parshat Miketz, Chapter 41, on page 231. Covering a lot of ground. Okay? So Joseph has now been, painting the scene, page 231. Joseph has now been taken out of this pit of despair. He's been there for 9 years, right? He is now given this incredible position, a rags-to-riches story. And so you would think, right? What's he thinking? So let's look at verse 50. It says, "Now to Joseph were born two sons when the year of famine had not set in, whom Asnat, the daughter of Potipharah, chief of On, bore to him." Okay, who is Asnat? Is actually a name as well, an Israeli name. In America, it doesn't go as well. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Menashe, for God had made me forget all my hardships and all my father's household. I got Menashe means I have amnesia. Right? I was suffering. My father's household, I went through so much pain and suffering. And now, because of my success, I am now forgetting all of my father's household. Right? Forget all my hardship and all of my father's household. And the name of the second he called Ephraim for, God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. So when he said it was a great line, I thought it was a great line. Basically, the two names are amnesia and assimilation, right? That's basically what it is. I am no longer a member of that tribe. I am done, right? They've caused me suffering, etc. And now I have assimilated. I am successful in the new world, right? I'm rich. Why didn't the brothers recognize him? Because he didn't look Jewish, right? Obviously, he looked very Egyptian.
Does he consider himself Egyptian?
It sounds from here that he does.
Yeah.
It sounds from here that he does. Now, clearly,
buried as an Egyptian.
He is, well, no, because he's buried in the land of Shechem. In other words, the last thing that we left out was he says to his family, please make sure that when the redemption comes.
Yeah, they dug his bones. They brought him.
He was entombed, no. Whatever it was, one of those things, right? And he said, make sure when the time comes that you get me out of here.
Right.
And he's buried, ironically, in the city of Shechem, a city that he didn't find his brothers in, and that's where his burial place is. You can go to Kever Yosef today. It's a lousy neighborhood, but at least you can see it from afar.
Asher's daughter, Sarah, was on the show.
Say it again?
Asher's daughter, Sarah.
Sarah Chabad Asher, right. Yeah. Yes, you learned that in Hebrew school.
Yeah.
It's a midrash. So a lot of stuff comes out. I'll tell you all the stuff that comes up from Hebrew school. Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories. So Joseph, at this point, it seems that Joseph is done with his family, right? So why doesn't Joseph call home? Why doesn't Joseph? He's done. At least from the text, from the way that he describes himself in his state of mind when he names his children, he's done. I'm out of here. I have found new success in a new land with a new culture, and I'm done. For amnesia and assimilation. I thought that was a good line. So let's go back to our possibilities, right?
He's a rich man.
He's the second, he's the most powerful man in the country. The second most powerful man in the country. Of the most powerful country in the region. Right? And let's remember, who's Jacob? Jacob's family is a small tribe. A tribe of 12. That's it. Right? And now he's the second in command in Egypt. It's night and day. So let's go through some of our answers here. Okay? So we mentioned... So Sharon, you mentioned the idea of teshuvah, right? Which I would save for the end, but Sharon, you came out. Go ahead. Because I think that's the best answer, right? Which answer? What is he trying? What is he trying to? He's trying to bring them in a situation where he, where they can repent, right? So, how does he do it?
Well, you have to make somebody feel the same way that you felt.
Ah, so now you're saying something else. So part of it is in order to go through the process of repentance, he has to put them in a situation where they felt the same way. So let's go through. How did he feel? Or did they try to? They tried to kill him, right? They didn't kill him, so he can't have them killed. So what would be appropriate punishment?
But if he sends them back with nothing, he just about killed them.
Well, then he doesn't.
If he would do that,
to send them back with no food,
right? He would just about. Doom them.
Or they would come back. I mean, he doesn't say, I'm going to kill you. He says, come back with your younger brother, right? So he gives them that out. He's not going to say, I'm going to starve you, right? I'll give you whatever you want, but just come back with what I asked for. So the first thing is, he puts them in a situation, though, where they constantly feel like their lives are at risk. They feel incredibly vulnerable, which, of course, is what he went through, right? But then...
It also makes them realize what it must have done to the father, because all of a sudden they realize what.
Okay. So this is. So I would have ended with this, but because Sharon, you're so smart, we have to. you stole the class.
You get another donut.
What does he demand? He demands them to bring Benjamin. right? And then Benjamin is brought. This really leads up to next week's portion, right? But even though, and what happens after they realize that Benjamin, after he frames Benjamin, what happens?
They have tremendous guilt because this is what their father told them not to do.
And then what happens?
To them?
What do the brothers do?
They go back.
Nope.
They offer themselves instead. Yeah, one of them offers.
How does he offer?
Who's the one?
To
who's the one?
Yeah.
Top of page 250, Parshat Vayigash. I mean, we end the story of this week's portion where they say, "Oh, what do we do?" and etc. and how could this happen? And now, what do we do?
The same child that we read about last week with Tamar, the same
Yehuda,
the child, right?
Same Yehuda.
The
same Yehuda. And then it says, in the beginning, page 250, Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Yehuda steps up because Yehuda is the leader, right? Yehuda steps up. And he gives this whole thing and says, "We are your slaves, etc., etc." And he gives a long soliloquy, very long, very verbose. Yehuda comes from the word Jew. Jews come from the word Judah. Jews talk a long time. What do they say? The greatest yitzhara, evil inclination for a Jew, and particularly a rabbi, is a microphone. Can't get them off. Right? So here, Judah talks for like several paragraphs. And he says, verse 30, "And now, if I become to your servant, my father, and the youth is not with us, since his soul is bound with us, with also, it would happen that when he sees his soul, the youth missing, he will die." Top of page 253. "And your servants will have brought down the hoariness of your servant, our father, in sorrow to the grave. For your servant took responsibility from the youth, from my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him down to you when I have sinned to my father for all time, now therefore please let your servant remain instead of the youth as a servant to my Lord,' and the youth go back with his brothers. Take me instead." Who says this? Judah. Now wait a second. If you're Joseph, right, and you say, "They got rid of me because they hated me, because I was the ben zekunim, of the son of the old age. I was the son of Rachel, who was their primary, who was Jacob's primary wife." Remember, we mentioned this all the time. This rivalry between Rachel, the children of Rachel, and the children of Leah has been from the beginning. Even in the story of Dinah, they said, "Hey, Dad, if this was Rachel's daughter, would you allow this to happen?" Right? You're treating us like second class citizens. There is a huge rivalry. "So now they got rid of me," says Joseph. Who's left?
Benjamin.
So here is their chance. They could just walk away. "Dad, I'm sorry." Joseph makes it easy for them. "Dad, I'm sorry. You know your favorite child now, the one that you're worried about, that anything could happen to him, the one you're putting around the bubble saying, 'God forbid, we should take him with us. We have to convince you.' Yeah, sorry, Dad. It's over. Sorry, I can't help you." That's what they could say in a second. Instead, who steps up? Judah, the one who sold Joseph in the first place. Judah is the one who says, no. "We can't let him go. Nafsho, k'shur b'nafsho. My soul is tied with his soul. We cannot leave without him. Take me instead. Let me be the slave and die rather than do this to my father and do this to my family." And when Joseph says this, he says, "Ani Yosef, Ha'odavichai," right? That's his response. He says, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" Now, they've been talking about their father for pages and pages. "My old father, we can't allow this, we can't do this. You know, if we do this, it'll kill my father," etc., etc. The Beit HaLevi, one of the great commentators, says, of course he knew his father was still alive. They're still talking about it. He said, when they say, "I can't," they're arguing, they say, "Please allow him to come back, because if it doesn't, it'll kill my father." He says, "Oh yeah? Well, I'm Joseph. And you got rid of me. Is my father still alive? Did it kill my father?" It didn't. So that argument is invalid. But they placed him in the exact situation that they found themselves in all these 22 years earlier. And they could have gotten rid of the favorite child, just like they did. And instead, they do the right thing. And Judah, of all people, steps up to the plate and allows them, and says, "Take me instead. And save the boy." So, Sharon, your argument is very valid, right? And very well said, because it's thought that really, what is he trying to do? He's trying to put them in a situation where there is tshuva gemura, complete repentance. My problem with that, Sharon, is that who the heck are you? You're going to play God, right? I should do this so you could... So I should put everybody in this torturous situation, and I should not call my father for 22 years, or at least 7 years when I had, or a couple years that I had the opportunity to. Sorry, this is not 2 years. This is 9 years, right? Because it's been 7 years of plenty, and now 2 years of famine. It's been 9 years, right? And I shouldn't call my father for all those 9 years, because I need to be placed into a situation where they can now forgive. They can now do what we call tshuva gemura, complete repentance, right? Put in, again, Maimonides writes, what's tshuva gemura, what's complete repentance? You're in the same situation, under the same circumstances, and you don't make the mistake that you did originally. You do the right thing instead of the wrong thing. But who is he to do that? So that's why that's another question in that regard, right? I would venture to say, as a response, that if he doesn't do that, and he calls his father and says, Dad, you're not going to believe what happened, right? I'm now second in command. And his father's going to go, how'd that happen? What's going on, right? Why? And they didn't have this whole process of healing. And then the family would be completely split. So it's possible that he did this to save the family, if you want to look at it from that route. Does that make sense? It's possible. It's
possible that he himself was not up to doing it.
He didn't want to.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, he said to hell with him.
Yeah,
right, again, and if you look at the naming of his children, that's kind of makes sense. There is one thing that...
Trust.
What?
There was no trust.
And now there was trust. And now Joseph would have trusted them because they proved themselves.
Right.
There is one thing that I want to point out because it seems to be... It's kind of hanging over there. And that is... on page 233. The first time that Joseph sees his brothers, and again, you learn a lot from the narrator. Joseph sees his brothers, and they recognize him, right? Verse 7. Joseph saw his brothers, and he recognized them, but he acted like a stranger toward them and spoke with them harshly. He asked, where are you from? Where did you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they didn't recognize him. Top of page 235. And then what does it say? Joseph recalled
the dreams
that he dreamt about.
It's coming through right in front of him.
So, I mean, again, the odds of all this playing out is just absurd. As I said, what's supposed to happen is that Joseph, who was a young man and strong and good looking, is going to be a slave, and he is going to be to die be worked to the death. That's what's supposed to happen. And the odds that all of these years later there's a reunion with the family, it's like a crazy thing. It's like almost they have to make a movie about this. Or a Broadway show, right? Or the Technicolor Dreamcoat. Right? There's no other way. I mean, it's made for TV, right? But it tells us that when he sees them, the first thing he remembers is his dreams. And he wants his dreams, says Nachmanides, Ramban. He wants his dreams to come true. Now, we say that phrase, oh, my dreams to come true, right? Right? That sounds kind of hokey and corny, right? But if you are Joseph and you're thinking that these dreams were some sort of prophecy, and you've seen that there's enough craziness to happen, the fact that a few years ago he was in a dungeon and basically waiting to die, and now here he's in this position? No. And even then he concludes, this is all the hand of God, right? But he wants his dreams to come true. What were his dreams? The first dream was?
The sheaves.
And the sheaves of, the first dream was?
That they would bow down.
That was not the dream. What was the dream? That was the interpretation. What's the dream?
The sheaves,
right? The sheaves would bow down to his sheaf of a bundle of wheat, right? By the way, what did they do for a living? The family.
They were shepherds,
right? So what are you supposed to be dreaming about?
Sheep.
You dream about work. You dream about sheep. He's dreaming about.
If you count the sheep,
right, he'd be sleeping. He wouldn't fall awake up, right? So he's dreaming about wheat, which is not the dream of a shepherd. It's the dream of a farmer, right? So what he's saying is, it's not just that he had a dream about work. He had a dream, and the dream has to mean that we're, A, either we're going to change careers, which is a possibility, or he said, and Rabbi Soloveitchik proposed that, or his dream was, I'm going to be the one who's feeding you.
Yeah,
wheat is the staple of mankind, right? And I'm going to be the one who's going to provide you with all of you. You will look to me to provide you with food.
They have
what?
They kill the sheep.
If they kill the sheep, they have meat. Yes, if you have no... But if there's a famine, the sheep die also, by the way. You keep that in mind. So wheat is still the... Wheat is what the sheep eat as well. Grass, wheat, etc. So he says, the first dream he has is that I'm going to be the head of this household, and I'm going to be the one to feed you. They don't like that. What's the second dream?
The stars and the moon and the sun. The moon and the sun, the
stone. And what do they do?
They bow down.
My son kept asking me, how does the sun bow down? I said, I don't have an answer. He's a very wise young man, right? My brother still calls him Irving. So they all bow down to him. Now that's something else. That's not I am the person who's going to provide for you. That's I am the leader. I am the master. And the master, not just the master of the brothers, but the master of the sun and the moon, which refer to, of course, the father and the mother. Ah, isn't the mother dead?
Not a question.
Though. Isn't the mother dead?
Yeah.
Right. But there's someone who takes the mother role. Who took the motherly role?
Bilhah.
In other words, all of the mothers will bow down to me. Right. And so, how is that going? He remembered them, and he remembered their dreams. The first dream is about to happen. They're about to buy food. I'm going to give it to them. That first dream is going to... Now I remember the second dream. And the second dream, it only happened if all of the 11 brothers are down here, and one is not down at this point, and Yaakov and the rest of the family come down as well, and they all have to bow down to me. Now, for some reason, and we find it disturbing, because it's just like, oh, it's a hokey dream, he felt that this dream was part needed to be come into fruition, and the only way to do this was through this whole thing. This whole game that he played. That makes sense? Maybe. I'm just going to throw in another opinion before we wrap up. One of that he wanted to get Benjamin, right? And he wanted to get Benjamin into his own, to have privacy of his own quarters, because in order to be able to reveal himself, he needs to know what's really going on with the family. How does he know that they're lying to him? And then they talked about, we lost one brother, my father's been devastated, etc., etc. How does he know they're telling the truth, right? He doesn't know anything. What does he need to do? He needs to get the one ally that he has, which is his youngest brother, who really doesn't know him, but at least he can reveal himself. He gets in and he says, hey, Ben, tell me the real deal. What's the story? What's going on at home? And then I can find out. And if things are smooth, right? If things are like they're describing, then I can reveal myself. Until then, I'm completely alienated. I'm done, right? I've forgotten my father's house. I forgot. I'm a stranger in a strange land. I found new success. I am Egyptian. I'm not Jewish. This is not my family anymore. But if you tell me that there was a dynamics and they have changed, so then maybe I should listen. And so the one opinion says that he wanted to make sure that he can get the real scoop. Yeah, that's about it.
So, 38, 40 years after he was sold.
22 years. 22 years. Because that's how old it is.
No, but wasn't like the 7 years of famine?
7 years of, years of famine and 2 years of, 7 years of hunger. I'm sorry, 7 years of plenty, 2 years of famine. Come 2 years into it, it was again. There's a whole guesstimate of how long.
But he was in prison for about what?
9 years.
Nine years.
We don't know all this. We're guesstimating at some point. We know the 9 years here, right? And we know Jacob is 130 years old at this point when he comes to Egypt. So all the numbers we're trying to figure out. There are certain discrepancies that I'm not so hung up on, but ever because that's. That's whatever, but at the end, the tradition was that he was gone for 22 years, and the irony, or the, there's no such thing as irony, was that Jacob was away from his family for 22 years, from his parents for 22 years, and some say that that's a direct punishment. Remember that nothing happens coincidentally in the book of Bereshit, right? In the Bible, there's cause and effect, right? Something bad happens to somebody, there's a reason. That's how the Torah. That's how the Bible works, right? That's how the stories of the biblical stories work. If something happens, it's not just haphazard. Something happened for a reason. Something bad happened.
Can't you just go back and say, well, Paul has oddness, you know, and bragging about the dreams. He kind of like brought him on himself too.
Yeah. But is that the punishment? Does the punishment fit the crime?
No. But it puts things in motion.
Right. Keeping in mind that Rabbi Soloveitchik spends a lot of quality time talking about Joseph, of the same name, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, and talked about how even within his dreams, Joseph has his head in the clouds, but at the same time, he's extremely practical, right? Why is... He runs the whole country, right? He brilliantly figures out how to run a country. And none of the... You know, we didn't mention this, but he is the prelude to the whole Exodus story, because at the end of Parshat Vayigash, he had the people approach him and say, "We're out of food," and he says, "Well, sell me your cattle," right, and they say, "We're out of land. We have no food anymore." And they say, "Sell me your land," and says, "Well, you know, and sell me yourself," etc., etc. And basically sets up a socialistic society where they get 80% and the government gets 20% and they own nothing. The government owns all the land and everybody is slaves, including the Jews. All of the entire Egyptian population were enslaved under this system, economic system, to the Pharaoh based on Joseph's initiation. And they hail him as a hero. They love him for it. It just, you know, as all socialistic societies, it leads to the possibility of abuse, right? So we can talk about that. It's a commentary on or abuse. The revolution follows the abuse, but it leads to abuse. The abuse is that they abused their powers, and so they abused the Jews as well, but they were all enslaved. They were provided for, and they were enslaved. Well, if you go back, you can go on, there's a recording of a class we gave on the different... On the Tower of Babel, if you remember, and the different approaches to the Depression, to the Great Depression, and the three different approaches to the Great Depression. That's a good class, by the way. The idea of providing for everybody is a very nice idea during the Great Depression, right?
We had Stalin, we had
Hitler, and Roosevelt. But those are the three different groups that we tackled and showed their different approaches on how to deal with the Great Depression. You can find it online, actually. It was very good. All right. So we thank you. Anybody have any other...